You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On March 27th, President Obama announced a new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. He argued that the growing radicalism in the area poses the single greatest threat to the American people and to the world. While many welcomed the change in strategy, some foreign policy experts feel that it doesn't go far enough. Leslie H. Gelb, a former New York Times columnist, now the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, is one of those critics, and he warns in his new book that power is still the main coin of the international realm, and America's future must be based on the principle of mutual indispensability. He explains how this plays out in Afghanistan, Pakistan, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, and elsewhere in his new book called Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to this show. Hi.
Good to be here.
In an article for the Daily Beast, you articulated some of the finer points of the new Obama strategy. Now, we can't go to all of them, but what are the most important ones as far as you're concerned?
Well, look, I agree with a number of things he's doing. The attempt to divide and conquer the Taliban, the attempt to give the friendly Afghans a head start, the attempt to organize neighbors into a coalition, those are all good things. The question is, where are they heading? What can they accomplish? The thing about power is it helps you determine what your goals should be because it helps you decide what's attainable. The worst thing you want to do is have unattainable objectives and fail because your power is destroyed by that.
Is that what happened during the second Bush administration? The second Bush presidency, not the first one, which you seem to admire a bit more.
Yes, it is what happened. They had a whole slew of unattainable objectives and failed and undermined American power.
My sense is that you're more strategically aligned with the James Bakers and Brent Scowcrofts of the first President Bush. Did he get it right?
I think he got some things very right, particularly the end of the Cold War. It was an amazing—
He didn't just luck out?
No. It was an amazing accomplishment because they ended the Cold War without war. You'll remember that people here in the United States, my fellow foreign policy experts and the politicians, were screaming, let's not cooperate with Gorbachev. He's a communist. He's trying to figure out how to strengthen the Communist Party. In fact, what Gorbachev was doing was dismantling the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and trying to bring about reform within the Soviet Union, just the kind of things we had wanted all along. And the Bush-Baker-Scowcroft approach was to help him dismantle the Soviet Empire.
He got a lot of criticism from people on the Republican right as well. People like Rush Limbaugh, who was screaming his head off about that.
Exactly.
Do you agree with President Obama that the greatest strategic threat facing the U.S. comes from Afghanistan and Pakistan?
No, I don't agree with it at all. I don't think the fate of the United States is going to be determined in the mountains of Afghanistan or even in the far more serious country of Pakistan. I think our fate will rest on how well we handle this economic problem here at home and in the world, because that's the basis of our democracy, and that's the basis of our international power, and that has to be the priority. I'm not saying walk away from Afghanistan, Pakistan. We can't, but we have to make it a lesser priority and deal with it in ways that our power can manage.
Well, you write that Obama repeatedly told his principal advisors that they needed an exit strategy. So where is it? Is there any exit strategy in the plan that he outlined the other day?
I didn't see it, because the exit strategy would be based upon what he called benchmarks. In fact, he said, no more blank checks. We're now going to hold the Afghans and the PACs to account with benchmarks. But if you listen to the rest of the speech, you didn't hear any benchmarks.
And
still aren't any benchmarks.
What happens with benchmarks? If they don't live up to them, then what do we do?
Well, that's part of the policy. You have to explain to the American people and to the countries we're trying to help what the consequences are of their not fighting for themselves. Because it never works unless they're willing to fight harder for their freedom than we are. Our power can't compensate for that gap.
It has been become rather fashionable to argue that we're in a post-American age with regard to global affairs. You don't agree with that?
It's nonsense. It really is. This isn't the post-American era. It is an era where our power relative to many other countries is less than it used to be. But we were never the dominant power. During the Cold War, if I remember correctly, there was a thing called the Soviet Union, the other major superpower. We didn't dominate. Even at the end of the Cold War, we couldn't tell other countries what to do. Now, we're in a period where power remains highly pyramidal, and we remain alone at the top. And what's more, the leaders of other countries in Europe, China, India, would not dispute what I'm saying for a second. They understand better than our foreign policy and experts here understand that no major problem in the world, global warming, trade, security, can be solved or managed without United States leadership.
And that's despite the fact that we are going through this economic crisis, and many people say that the Bush administration severely damaged the U.S.'s image around the world and our ability to convince other people to go along with us.
All those things are true, and we're still at the top alone, and they still look to us for leadership. At the G20, President Obama couldn't dictate to the other countries there, but basically they were waiting for us to set the outlines of what to do, and they did begin to move in our direction.
My guest is Leslie H. Gell, Pulitzer Prize winner when he was with the New York Times, and now with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book, Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. It's published by Harper. I assume you watched the Somali pirate crisis over the weekend. How well do you think that the president handled that situation?
I think he did good. I think he gave the proper instructions to the U.S. Navy, that is, get some people on board the destroyer near that raft, and if you get an opportunity, shoot him. I don't believe for a moment the orders were, if you see the captain's life in danger, they can't make judgments like that. But in effect, everyone understood, if you can take them out, take them out. That's the right thing.
Although there are people who are arguing now that this escalates the whole situation. We're much more likely to see hostages killed rather quickly.
Yeah, I think people who argue that it escalates the situation are just looking to make arguments. What did they want? They wanted us to stay with our destroyers hovering around that raft for the next 3 years? Be realistic. The foreign policy debate in this country is just cockeyed. And frankly, that's the main thing that drove me to write this book.
Well, I'm glad you corrected your English. I was getting worried. I saw a news report recently that suggested that the way we cover the piracy situation is skewed because we ignore all of the things that have angered people in Somalia, like the dumping of waste in the nearby waters and some of the other things that have really...
I don't think that has anything to do with the piracy. I think this is an international criminal operation that looks to make money, and they couldn't give a damn of what we're depositing anywhere. What's dangerous now is, as soon as the foreign policy community and the politicians get their hands on something like this, they say, now we've got to do something about it. They bid up the threat. They bid up the U.S. objectives. They say, now we need to build all these literal ships to patrol, you know, very close to Somali shores. And the problem really is not in the waters off Somalia. It's Somalia itself. What do they want us to do? Go invade Somalia and take that country over? I think we tried that before. It didn't work.
What about some of the other foreign policy challenges that the president faces? For example, what's going on in the Middle East? The recent choice of Benjamin Netanyahu to be the next leader of Israel, the continued volatility in Gaza and elsewhere,
yes.
A situation that seems to be almost impossible to resolve.
Well, here again, focusing on what our objectives can be, what's attainable, and what we can accomplish it with our power, there is an answer that's possible for us, and that is to step back from all the focus on the negotiating table, where we push the Palestinians and Israelis to sit down with each other and compromise, and they don't, and they haven't. And every time we do that, they fail. And it only radicalizes the politics on both sides even more. What we've got to do is step back from the negotiating table and build constituencies for political compromise among Palestinians and Israelis, the way George Mitchell and the Brits did in Northern Ireland. After years of unsuccessful negotiations at the table, they stepped back. They built up women's groups, Catholics and Protestants, business groups, Catholics and Protestants, and all of a sudden the politicians had support for making deals, for compromising, for making peace. We have to take that 2 or 3 year period, letting everyone know what we're doing, to reestablish a political support for compromise at the negotiating table.
But in Ireland, the United States was more of an objective participant. In the Middle East, most people feel, whether Israelis feel this way or not, but most people feel that the United States has always skewed on the side of Israel, which makes it hard to see it as an unbiased power broker.
You know, but in critical moments, we have been an unbiased power broker. We've protected Israeli interests, but we've pressed for compromise. Look at the Sinai withdrawal agreement between Israel and Egypt. We pushed the Israelis very hard.
That was Dwight D. Eisenhower. That's a long time
ago.
No.
Nixon and Kissinger.
I was thinking about Nixon and Kissinger.
I'm not talking about Suez, but we did in Suez, to be sure. More recently, in 73, they put together the Sinai Agreement where we really squeezed the Israelis. And it was for good purpose, because there's been peace between Egypt and Israel since then.
But might it be a better idea to bring somebody else in to handle those negotiations?
No, because they won't pay attention to anyone else. Everyone in that area understands there's only one possible power broker for the negotiations, and that's the United States. They don't pay any attention to the Europeans. They think the Europeans really aren't interested in doing anything except playing up to the Arabs. And the Chinese and Russians don't really play a role. It's us. And that's something we have to realize and use our power in a sensible way.
And the power is recognized elsewhere. Netanyahu said about Iran, stop Iran or I will.
You're right. I know he said that. And maybe any Israeli prime minister has to wave that club around. But Vice President Biden also said that it would be highly inadvisable for Israel to take military action against Iran. And I think the Israelis understand that. It's not like knocking out the nuclear reactor in Iraq years ago, because we aren't even sure where all the nuclear facilities are in Iran. And I don't think the Israelis know any more about that than we do. And we would suffer the consequences of military action every bit as much as they would. It wouldn't accomplish its military objective, and it would spark another round of international terrorism. I think the Israelis will forbear and let us play out the negotiating scheme with Iran, which will take the next 3 or 4 years.
And we'll come back to Iran after we take a little break. My guest is Leslie H. Gelb, who's president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, former columnist for the New York Times, where he was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for exemplary journalism. He has also worked on the other side, not just in journalism. He's been a senior official in the State and Defense Departments. And now he's written a book that draws upon all of that experience called Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. It is published by Harper. Stay with us. We're back with Leslie H. Gelb. His latest book, Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. It's published by Harper's. You've said in interviews that we should begin the process of negotiations with Iran. Within 10 years, Iran will be our closest ally in the region. Really? Wouldn't that require more encouragement from Iran at a time, for example, when the president reached out to it, Iran immediately imprisoned an American journalist, which seems to me to be sending a signal. It's happened in the past. Every time there seemed to be a possibility of a rapprochement, something would occur. I'm not going to speak about what Americans have done, but the Iranians have thrown monkey wrenches into any number of possible rapprochements.
Absolutely, and they will in the future, too. The rulers of that country don't have our best interests at heart. These are guys who are giving us a hot foot all over the region, and they're a real problem. And negotiations with them will take 3 or 4 years to materialize. But what we have to understand is, essentially, those rulers are a thin line at the top of Iran's own internal power grid, that most of that country is quite pro-American. I remind you of just one thing that people forget. After 9/11, in every Arab country, millions poured into the streets to celebrate the attack against the United States. In Iran, millions poured into the streets in sympathy with us. The underlying feeling toward us, the middle class society, the willingness of people in that country, even today, to speak out, is extraordinary. And it gives us real hope for the future if we let things evolve. You can't beat this leadership over the head. And you have to understand they're scared about American economic power and letting in the global economy to Tehran, because while they need it, while their economy is in trouble, they fear it because it means the end of their power, as it has in every one of those dictatorships.
Well, the Shah had earlier tried to modernize Iran, and that was one of the things that led to his overthrow, along with his autocratic rule and a few other terrible things that he was doing.
Yeah.
But there was fear of Iran seems to be caught in this bind between wanting to be a major power and play a role in international politics and also being afraid of it.
Yeah, but we shouldn't make Iran into more of a power than it is. We've given it a lot of free power during the Bush years by calling it, you know, the regional superpower. Well, you know, Iran has an economy about equal to the state of Wisconsin, military capability roughly equal to California's National Guard and Reserve. They're nowhere near equal to American power.
Despite their oil riches?
Despite their oil riches, they still import half their gas, and their country is living in poverty. It's a terrible situation for them.
What advice would you give President Obama on dealing with their nuclear program?
I would say everything ought to be on the table on our side and their side, and we begin to walk it through. In the end, I don't believe they will completely abandon their nuclear enrichment program. And how could we expect them to do that? Because here we've accepted a nuclear program for North Korea. We were even going to sell them light water nuclear reactors. We accepted an India nuclear program, a Pakistani program, an Israeli program. And the Iranians are going to say, why not just a uranium enrichment program for us as a standby security? They're never going to give that up. The question is the inspection and verification to see that they aren't moving beyond it.
Is any of this possible without getting Russia on board?
I don't think it is. I make the point in the book because I think it's, again, plain, simple, common sense. The United States is the indispensable leader, but we need equally indispensable partners like Russia on the issue of Iran in order to accumulate enough power to get the job done. And we need Russia on Iran.
Well, there seems to be a widening gap between the United States and Russia. And also, there seems to be a growing totalitarian sensibility in Russia.
Yeah, it's a very nasty place at this time. And they are flexing their muscles because they feel their muscles, principally economic. And we have to take that into account because they are in their sphere, on their borders, a major power. And it means taking their interests into account as well as moving in the direction we want. And yes, I know this is a horrible word to utter in American politics and foreign policy thinking, but we're going to have to compromise with them in order to move in the direction we want. And then if we accomplish something, we'll make another compromise, but keep moving in the direction. We can't have it our own way. It's a situation of mutual indispensability. They need us. We need them.
You praise China for how it's leveraged its growing economic clout. How would you characterize Chinese behavior during the current downturn?
Well, I'd describe it as very sensible because they realize that their relative position is stronger than it used to be. They now have an economy that's probably in better shape to recover than ours, and they want their voice heard. They want more of a place at the table, and we do the same thing in their shoes. I don't see any conflicts of vital interest between us and China.
What about North Korea?
Well, North Korea,
they have been a major roadblock, haven't they, in resolving the North Korean problem?
Absolutely not. The fact of the matter is we had several deals with the North Koreans under Clinton, and then, don't forget this, under Bush in his last year, we had a deal with them. And the Chinese were instrumental in making that deal happen. Again, mutual indispensability. They didn't want North Korea to go nuclear and knew we had to be in the lead because we were the principal worry to North Korea. And we needed Chinese power to make a deal work. And they weighed in. But, you know, they're more realistic than we are about what can and can't be done. I listened to the debate about this missile test in North Korea, where people were getting on these cable talk shows day and night saying, we've got to do something about this. This is the most dangerous threat. And what the devil did they propose doing? Did they suggest anything? No. They were hinting we should take military action, go blow up North Korea. But the biggest impediment to blowing up North Korea is South Korea. The South Koreans think this is the last thing the United States should do, because if we attack the North, it would take the North 2 hours to completely destroy Seoul, which is the heart of the South Korean economy. And we'd never have another ally again if we did it. And the foreign policy experts and politicians know this, and they go ahead and pretend otherwise. And what was the outcome? The outcome was, you should pardon the expression, another UN resolution promising more sanctions, economic sanctions. What more economic sanctions? This country is already in utter poverty. So the foreign policy debate here distorts a common sense approach to North Korea, which is to continue to squeeze them, contain them, and deter them, and in time, they will fold.
My guest is Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for what he wrote when he was with the New York Times. He served in both the Defense and State Departments. He's written a book now called Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy, published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've worked on foreign policy issues with Joe Biden. Are you still in a close friendship, and are you still an advisor?
No, I'm not an advisor. I have this thing from my journalistic days that I'll talk to any politician, but I don't become advisors to them. If they want to talk to me, I'm happy to tell them what I think.
But didn't you work on him on the plan that he came up to federalize Iraq?
Exactly.
Boy, am I glad you still subscribe to that?
I do, but most Iraqis don't seem to. What we're really saying is that the Iraqis better make a political deal among themselves, because if they don't, by the time we leave, they'll be back to full-out civil war. We suggested decentralization, a federal approach, because that's where we both felt the power was inside Iraq, that they could make a deal on that basis. But it isn't going that way now. In fact, it isn't going anyway. And they're in danger of a political stalemate as we withdraw. And that's the most dangerous thing imaginable for them.
Does Iraq put to rest the whole debate over nation building?
No, it doesn't put to rest, because we are Americans. And the whole idea of nation building is the best and the worst of us. You know, it's the best in the sense that we want to fix up other countries, make them better. In fact, we're willing to take on enterprises in other countries we aren't willing to do here. We want to reform the Pakistani educational system so that the radical madrasas don't take over the secular schools. We can't fix up our own public education system here in this country. We're going to fix up the one in Pakistan. It's nuts. But the impulse in Americans is to be helpful, to try to do these things. And when we do, we reach way beyond our power. Our power comes when states deal with each other, when they're in the international arena. It's much harder for our power to reach inside societies and change and fix them. And we ought to know that from the difficulties we have in dealing with our own internal problems.
A caller quotes Tony Judd of the Remark Institute, who argues that Israel has only the United States as a friend who cosets it, and without any support, they might actually have reason to go to the bargaining table with Palestinians and find a compromise on Iran. Do you agree or disagree?
I completely disagree with Tony. He's a very serious scholar of European affairs. I don't think that he quite gets the Middle East. And there is a tendency to lay all problems off on the Israelis and to forgive the problems on the Arab side. I think in this case, the way to bring about compromise by the Israelis when the time is right is for them to have confidence that we are on their side, even as we're squeezing them to make the final deals. And if they don't have that confidence, they won't make the deal.
Now, your subtitle is How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy.
Right.
So you think American foreign policy has to be rescued?
Yeah, I do.
How would you rescue it?
Well, as you can hear from what I'm saying, I think the problem is not foreign policy, sensible foreign policy people sitting down and figuring out attainable objectives, what we can or cannot do to achieve them. We more or less agree on that until the demons of foreign policy take over and begin to dominate the debate. The demon of principle or ideology or dogma, our ideals like nation building. Secondly, our domestic politics, where nobody wants to be accused of being weak. And thirdly, the arrogance of power, we can do anything. And once those demons get a hold of the debate, whether it's on piracy or Korean missiles or dealing with Afghanistan, the common sense goes out the window. Common sense is rooted in American society. That's what made us great, pragmatic problem solving. It's why when Sully Sullenberger successfully landed that plane in the Hudson River, we all cheered because, by God, there was an American displaying competence again. He showed we could get the job done.
Isn't part of the problem that you can come up with some real sensible approaches and then something happens? 9/11, for example, or a war breaks out that you didn't predict, or a ship is hijacked, or any number of other things, and suddenly you have to fight that fire that you weren't even planning to have to deal with.
Well, it depends how you're going to fight the fire.
Can you make long-range plans for things that you can't predict?
You got to go explain to people, including my colleagues and responsible politicians, what we can and can't do. As soon as these crises appear, up goes cable news with these people saying this is the most dangerous thing since sliced bread. And the United States must eliminate all sliced bread. And they say it day after day. And foolishly, presidents bend to it. And they start to get carried away, as President Obama did with the Korean missile test. Most dangerous thing. What was he talking about? They are eons away from being able to launch a missile at Sarah Palin's house in Alaska. And when they reach that point, they will understand that if they made any move toward doing that, we would then totally destroy them. Deterrence has always worked. Throughout the Cold War, you sat here with all sorts of people saying, oh, the Soviet Union and China, they want to fight nuclear wars. They didn't. We deterred them.
What do you see happening in other parts of the world? The European Union seems to be experiencing a lot of stress. Africa is trying to put together some kind of African Union and is finding it very difficult.
I don't recall any period in history where there have been as many problems as we see now, internally and internationally. I call this a period of drownings, which is drowning in problems. And it means all the more that our common sense requires that we make priorities. We decide what the most important things are to do. And
you think Hillary Clinton is the right person for that job?
I don't get involved in that stuff. I think we've got to make the priorities, and I think the basic priority is our economy, as I said. You know, you look back on the things we worried about and how we survived them. Almost everybody was saying after World War II, when the Soviet Union took over Eastern Europe, that Europe was gone. But last I looked, we won the Cold War. And Mao took over China, and they said Asia would be gone. Last I looked, they're our biggest investor. Vietnam, our biggest enemy for more than a decade, we invited them to be in the Security Council. The Vietnamese president visited George W. Bush in the White House. We made a deal with Muammar Gaddafi, where he gave up terrorism, his weapons of mass destruction, and we invited him into the UN Security Council, too. Our power to use our diplomacy, our deterrence, our containment skills can deal with these problems if our basic economy holds.
But will the world even pay much attention considering the failures we've had? For example, Iraq. We went in to Iraq and couldn't handle the problem. We can't handle the problem in Afghanistan. Right. We seem to be losing in Afghanistan.
If we do dumb things like that, then the world will pay less attention to us. But Obama's been in for 2 months. Let's see how he handles it. But if he fails, he will lose his power and people will look to us less.
How much time should we give him? I mean, 2 months is very brief.
It's nothing. I think within 2 years we'll have a sense of really what he's going to do with Iraq and Afghanistan and whether some of these economic plans he's laid on the table will take hold.
Just one more thing. What did you think of the president's European tour? Was that a success?
It was a success as what I call scene-setting power, that is, getting people back on our side. But people ought not to confuse scene-setting or what others call soft power with real power. It changed the mood, the attitudes, the atmosphere, but it didn't get the Europeans to change their position on the major issues. That requires real power.
And obviously the title of your book is a wordplay, Power Rules, The Rules of Power, and also Power Rules. Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy, published by Harper. My great thanks to Leslie H. Gelb for being our guest today.
Enjoyed it.